Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, coming to you Saturday afternoons here on News Talk 580 KMJ and KMJ580.com. It'll be another slightly abbreviated version today with Bulldog Baseball pregame show coming up at 1:45. Our guest today is a gentleman that you may have read about in the Fresno Bee. Luke Griswold does such a great job covering Tulare and Kings counties for the Bee, and he's had a couple entries in his column about Ray Malikian of Visalia and his incredible story. He's a P-40 pilot who actually flew his own plane 65 years after he lost it in the Pacific. So it's a very entertaining story, and maybe he'll set me straight if anything I said there was not quite accurate. But let's go back to the beginning, Ray, and I understand you're now 90 years old. Is that right? Do I have your age right?
I'll be 91 in June if I'm lucky.
Oh, well, you've been pretty lucky so far, so we don't expect that to change for you.
Yeah, but I do.
So, and you grew up here in the valley, a Biola farm boy, as
grew
I understand.
Grew up in the Biola area there. My dad was a rancher there, and I think about that time they didn't have a dehydrator there, but they were farming a few acres of raisin grapes. And went to school in the little two-room schoolhouse, and went to Kerman High School, and then went on to Fresno State.
So you were a mighty lion at Kerman High.
Yeah.
And then decided to be a Bulldog. And somewhere along the line, Uncle Sam got a hold of you. Now, I understand you got into the war, and with your age, this makes sense, because you're among the older of the surviving World War II veterans in your 90s now. You were actually in the service before World War II started, right?
Yes, I was. About a year before. You know, I was, I got in the service, the war started when Hitler came up and all that baloney, and he invaded Poland, and everybody declared war, and Congress, in all their knowledge, decided to have a draft, and it was from 18 to 38, and I figured I was a good candidate and didn't want any part of that. And as a kid, I had balls of little 10, 15 cents packages of buy of airplanes and cutouts and all that. I used to fix them together, but all my damn models crashed, so I wasn't sure if I get an airplane, I wouldn't crash. So I was interested in airplanes. I used to go to Chandler Field sometimes and watch them. So I was born in 1918, and, you know, read some of those Blue Max and Eddie Rickenbacker and stories and all that in the Pulp magazine, and that's good. What got my interest.
And so in 1940, you enlisted?
And I was going to school and with a couple of guys in a little apartment and all that. I kept thinking about joining, and one of the Air Force recruiting team came through, and I opened my big mouth, and one of the kids said, you talked about it a little and many times, why don't you do it? So I went down, signed up.
So you were kind of egged on.
Yeah, but I wanted to do it anyway. I sure as heck didn't want to be in the infantry and use a shovel or a hoe anymore. I was through with that.
Now, did you have a pretty good idea that there would be war coming for the United States and that you would be seeing action, or were you not thinking about that at the time?
Well, the draft started, so you had to be thinking about it. After calling up everybody from 18 to 38, we thought that there would be a war. And I didn't want to be in the infantry, and I thought I could be a pilot, and I made it. So I signed up. It was late in 1940 when I went in and made my application and all that, and they called me around November, I think, or December, and said I had been accepted, and I was going to Fort MacArthur in Long Beach to take my final oath. It's amazing that I, at Fort MacArthur, put up my hand and joined the Air Force, that a few years later, I'd be in the command of his son, Doug MacArthur. The fort in Long Beach was named after his father.
Mm-hmm. And he was a long way from being called Dugout Doug at that point.
Yeah, well, he was called other names, too.
Some of which you may not want to share with us on the radio today.
That's exactly right.
We're talking to Ray Malikian of Visalia. He's 90 years old. He flew P-40s during World War II, the P-40 Warhawk, famously used by Claire Chennault and his Flying Tigers in China. That's not where Ray ended up. And I imagine, first of all, now people say you decided to join the Air Corps and you got to fly, and that sounds real easy. But I've talked to so many guys who wanted to be pilots, and it didn't work out for them because this was a pretty tough process. All the training, not just in the air, but in the books. Yeah, they had quite a bit to learn and quite a bit to get to know about being a pilot. Was that a difficult process for you, or did it go pretty quickly?
Well, it went pretty quickly. The most important part of it, of course, the flying. A lot of people didn't make it. A lot of kids didn't make it, but they tried hard. I think Roosevelt at that time said he wanted 50,000 pilots a year. He knew there was going to be a war, and he knew we needed pilots. And so every little town here and there was held. Tulare and Visalia had a primary flying school. It might be interesting to you to know that Richard Baum, who shot down more airplanes in the Pacific than anybody else, took his primary training in Tulare.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up being personal friends with him when we were overseas.
With Dick Bong?
Yeah. We got good friends. In fact, I was a couple of weeks before he died, he came to see me. I was back then. And it's a test pilot at Lockheed. I said, for crying out loud, see if you can get me a job at Lockheed, a test pilot. I'm bored here. And he didn't make it. Luckily, I didn't either. Anyway, I joined, went to Hammett for primary training, and went to San Antonio for my basic and advanced training. From there, I went to Hamilton Air Force Base in San Rafael. It's long gone now, but it was a pursuit squadron, as they call it in the old days. We call it a fighter now.
And you know it's long gone because you just flew over the grounds and saw a bunch of houses there. And we're going to get to that part of the story here pretty soon. Now, I know another thing that all the pilots that I've talked to, at some point, they had to make the decision, were they going to fly fighters or bombers, single engine, multiple engine? What was that choice posed to you, or was that choice made for you?
That choice was made for me. I didn't know anybody had a choice. And I'm really surprised that I became a fighter pilot, because the cockpits were fairly small, and that a tall guy wouldn't fit it. And during the when I got over in the Pacific and all that, we all had a one-man life raft that we sat on with a parachute. But if I had one and I sat on it, I couldn't close the canopy, so I never could wear one.
So if you went down, you were on your own.
I didn't like to get too far from land. Anyway, I was sent to, Hamilton Air Force Base, and I flew P-36 a little bit. It was a little bit smaller.
Yeah.
And a good airplane, too, and then graduated to P-40s, and it wasn't the easiest place airplane in the world to fly. It never was, not fly, but take off. I remember the instructor standing on my wing and talked to me and said, Malikian, don't you wreck this airplane now, because the government's got $35,000 in it. I always thought maybe I'd have to pay for it if I cracked it up.
Good motivation for coming back in one piece.
Right. When I took off, I darn it cracked it up. It pulled the torque on that propeller's engine going one way, and it pushed it to the left completely. So if you didn't keep your foot in the right rudder, it would take you right off the runway. And the instructor warned me, now be careful, it's going to do that. Yeah, hotshot pilot, it won't do that to me. But it did, and I kind of went crossways to the runway. And WPA workers there, you see shovels flying in the air, guys diving for the trenches. But I made it up, and after that I was a bit careful.
Yeah, I think they proved their point to you there, and you gave a few people a scare.
Right.
And you would face much more difficult circumstances by the time the war was over. The war hadn't even begun at this point, but it was about to. And, in fact, I understand that you and your fighter group were on your way to the Pacific.
We were ordered. years in 1941, late in 1941, we were going to go to Philippine Islands, and there were two convoys. The first convoy with all the guys that had been there for quite a while wanted to go because where we were going in Manila, they called the base there the Country Club of the Pacific. You could hire a boy for $1 to take care of all your needs. You had to have a white, dinner uniform and all that. I got my whites and all that. Anyway, they took off a couple of weeks. We did, and the poor guys ended up in Philippines.
Bataan Death March, huh?
Yeah, we were 2 weeks later.
You're talking about Clark Field is where you were headed?
Yeah, we were headed there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I asked one of the guys who finally got up. He saw my baggage. He said, "I don't know, but he was on the pier getting my baggage when the Japanese were bombing it." Anyway, we hit Pearl Harbor on the 3rd or 4th and left the night before. And, of course, Pearl Harbor happened then, and we were detoured to the Pacific.
So you had been in Pearl Harbor just 3 days before the Japanese attacked there.
Right. See how lucky I was all this time?
But you got to Manila too late. Or you were going to go to Manila, and it was bombed, of course, on December 7th as well, and Clark Field was decimated with all those airplanes on the ground, and the survivors ended up as prisoners on the Bataan Death March and in POW camps, many of them until the end of the war.
Right.
So you got diverted to Australia, which sounds a lot more inviting than Pearl Harbor or Manila under a Japanese assault.
And the Aussies didn't really expect us. We got there, and they gave us a blanket and said, "Hey, go to the racetrack here," which was near, and "spend the night. We'll try to find room for you." And one of the Aussies said there was a new hotel, the first modern hotel in Brisbane. So we jumped the trolley, got there, and they had rooms, and we parked there for a while. And actually, I heard you could call home, so I picked up the telephone, called my folks from there, and I made it.
How about that? I want to ask you, we're going to have to take a commercial break here in a moment, but before we do that, I want to ask you about that. You're in Pearl Harbor, and then you're on your way to Manila. You get diverted because the war is on now, and what you were bracing for, what you had a feeling might happen, actually is happening. At that point, did it change your mentality, your outlook, your expectations at all, knowing that now the United States was at war and you were definitely going to be seeing some combat?
Well, we knew we were going to be, but I don't think we really believed what it would be like. So we were going to get in there, we're going to fight the other airplanes and all that sort of stuff. Until we realized our airplane wasn't as good as theirs. Theirs was more lighter, more maneuverable, and faster and all that. And if you dogfight, as we call it, with a Japanese Zero, you were dead. No question about it. They could outfight you. So the only recourse we had was to, and we were told this, you make one pass at it and you get the hell out of there, and then you got a chance to come back for another one, because you turn around and get back at him, he'll cut your circle and he'll cut you in pieces too.
Well, it sounds like you are listening, because you're here talking to us today, and I know you have some of those stories to share with us. We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, more with 90-year-old Ray Malikian of Visalia, including how he ended up flying the very same P-40 that he flew in World War II just about a week ago here in California. It's an incredible story, and we'll get the rest of it next. It's Hometown Heroes today on News Talk 580 KMJ.
That song, very appropriate as we chat with a World War II fighter pilot today, Ray Malikian of Visalia, 90 years old. Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Perhaps you saw Mr. Malikian's picture in Sunday's Fresno Bee, an article by Lou Griswold. If you saw that picture, you noticed that on the cockpit of the P-40 he's sitting in, there are three Japanese flags underneath his name on the side of that canopy. And those, of course, represent the kills that he was credited with during World War II. Five kills makes you an ace, so he was more than halfway there. One of his good friends during the war was the most decorated P-38 ace of all time, the late, great Dick Bong. You heard him talk about that a little bit. But, Ray, let's talk more about you. We heard about how you were at Pearl Harbor just before the Japanese attacked, on your way to Manila, which they attacked the same day, so you were diverted to Australia. A little bit of cat and mouse for a while, and you guys actually had to put your planes together once you got over there. How long was it until you started flying missions in the Pacific?
What happened? We got our planes together, and more pilots were coming over, and more planes. And we were in a process of training, and most of the people didn't have any training. I only had 35 hours, and these poor pilots coming over probably had less than that, and I was one of the trainees, for God's sakes.
And, 35 hours is not a lot of airtime when you're going to be fighting for your life.
Right. Actually, before we left Hamilton Air Force Base for the Philippines, we had to have some gunnery. I know for strafing practice, we went out, they had an old pasture out there that had a bale of hay out there, and they said, well, 20 rounds in each gun, fired the bale of hay, and came back, and you were qualified. And before we left, the operation officer came by and said, Ray, you haven't had any aerial gunnery. I said, no, I haven't. He said, well, we're going to put 50 rounds in that airplane over there. This is in San Francisco. Go out in the ocean, fire a wide cap, and come back. I did, aimed at a wide cap and killed it because I know it disappeared. And came back to your qualified gunner.
Well, the surfers may have been upset with you about that for killing their white cap.
Well, it disappeared.
238 missions. That is an eye-popping number, and I've talked to a lot of pilots over the years on this show and my work on television with World War II veterans. 238 missions. That's a staggering number. Now, some of these are escort missions, and a lot of this is strafing, I guess, right?
Strafing and groundwork, just plain groundwork. Troop support, basically, of one way or the other. Protecting the troops from bomber attacks and things like that.
And I imagine that among those 238, there are at least a few where somebody was shooting at you, too.
Well, that we're supposed to. On my first mission in Darwin, we got the alert. We crawled up finally to about 20,000 feet. That's about as high as it got. That 20,000 feet, the P-40 was really not flying. And I was looking at my windscreen and were spots on. I said, God, there's bugs in this place. Look, and look to me like the whole damn Japanese Air Force.
Well,
I told the other three guys, I said, well, I'll take on the leader, and you guys get on each side of me, and we'll fly through them, which we did. I took on the leader, fired at him. The other guys fired, and we turned around thinking maybe we could catch him, but there's no way we could outclass us. And about that time, one of the guys said, Malik, zero, zero. And I looked up, and the zero come right straight on me, and I said, there's no place for me. Do what they told. Get out of there and come back another day. And I think that's where I got my first combat. But Darwin was the Australians were supplying us with food in Darwin. It was pretty bad, and somebody tried to start a cattle company with water buffaloes and didn't work, and they turned them loose, and there were thousands of them out there. Went out with rifles. We thought we'd shoot one and have some meat. We couldn't get close to them. So somebody got the idea we'd take a P-40 and pick on one and shot him. So one of the guys went up and killed one. We dragged it in, cut the meat up, made hamburger out of it, and cooked, ground it twice and served it to us, and you still couldn't eat the damn thing. It was so tough.
So it was. You did a little hunting with your P-40.
Right. So we had our mutton sausages and our dehydrated cabbage and all that sort of stuff. But it was fun. Something terrible happened though in Darwin. On one of the alerts we had on takeoff, before that, an airplane landed, a little passenger airplane parked alongside the runway, and our new general had been appointed for the fighter command, and a life photographer was there. As we got the alert, of course, we jabbed and hit the throttle as fast as we can, and one my pilots, unbeknownst to me, lost the airplane and crashed into him and killed both of the general and Jacoba. The poor guy saw a psychiatrist for a month or so and brought him back to the squadron. Sometime later, we'd gone to Townsville someplace to bring airplanes back, and we were flying low over the Great Barrier Reef on our way to... we always had to have a twin engine to do our navigating for us.
Mm-hmm.
I got a call of it and said, Bob just crashed, and turned around and looked, and there was poor Bob with his tail just sticking out of the water, and it crashed in there. And sometimes I wonder what if he did do it on purpose, but the poor guy couldn't get that out of his mind.
He was haunted by it. Boy, yeah. Your heart goes out to people in that situation.
These things are not very nice.
Well, and I know there are a lot of memories that stick in your brain, some lighthearted moments from the war, some that I'm sure that you would like to forget. Let me ask you about the kills. You get those flags painted on your canopy, and I know all your other friends that are pilots, not necessarily that there's a competition, but you do talk about it. It is an attention getter. Was that something where when the first one of those got painted on your airplane that it did produce some pride for you, or it meant something to you?
Well, it's always a surprise when you do it, but, you know, there's somebody in those planes, and you never think of when you shot down an airplane, that's all you think about. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm surprised that I got one. And most of the time it was lucky. The guy, it was in the wrong spot. The second one I got, we were low, and we were jumped. And I had a head-on shot. We were coming together. And somebody had said, and that supposedly knew, that on a head-on shot like that, the first guy that breaks, the one that gets shot down. So I didn't break. I said, it's going to be one hell of a crash if he does it.
A high-speed, high-altitude game of chicken, huh?
Game of chicken, that's right. It wasn't high altitude. It was low altitude.
Uh-huh.
I could do it.
A little higher than a car on the ground, anyway. But you guys,
I guess I shot him down. I'm here.
You're here talking to me. I think that is proof enough. So 238 missions. When did you finally get to come home? You talked to bomber pilots from Europe during the war, and early on, 25 would get them home. Then they changed it to 35. Apparently, I'm sure you got some leave between all of that. But yeah, when did you finally come home?
We'd always save up enough money, and then we get on leave.
Mm-hmm.
We always spend it on leave. But actually, I could have come home in a year's time if I wanted to, or sooner. But I was having so much fun and enjoying it so much, I wanted to stay. So I stayed another year. And about that time, I was really burned out. But it was a close-knit group. And the guys that came with us on the boat and the guys that got there first, most of them were in regular Army. And they had been first lieutenants and captains for probably 15 years in the old Army. It took 15 years to become a captain.
Uh-huh.
And all of a sudden, these guys were colonels and generals, and we were all friends, and we could do no wrong. Anytime I got in trouble, I'd package all the orders and all the endorsement papers and send it to one of the guys and said, get this guy off my butt.
So you had friends in high places.
Yeah.
Now, so you're saying that you caused some trouble?
Not really. I'll tell you one time what happened. I'll tell you two. I was on leave in Sydney, I think it was, and on my way really back, get a ride back to New Guinea, and I came across Colonel Worksmith, who was then head of the group or fighter command, I don't remember which, but he was way up there and all that. He said, what are you doing, Ray? And I said, leave's up, I'm going home. He said, he said, I got an extra bedroom in my apartment. Come stay with me another week and then go. So I didn't bother telling anybody. Everybody, I never showed up. Everybody thought I'd crashed. Everybody thought I'd AWOL and the whole darn thing. When I got bed, I had a whole pile of letters to answer and all that. Again, I said it to Worksmith, he took care of it. in the Army, I guess, in the Air Force, the sergeants are all the ones that do all the scrounging and fighting, finding things out and all that. They can do anything for you. in New Guinea, you get a lot of rain and muddy and all that. And one of the guys found an Aussie lumber mill where we were cutting lumber for who, I don't know. So they made deals by trading whiskey and egg ketchup and whatever it is. And we managed to get enough lumber to put floors on every camp, officers and enlisted men included. So about that time, I'd become squadron commander. We got orders to move to another base a couple of hundred miles away. And the orders were, leave everything there. Don't take anything. And I looked around and said, oh, I'm not going to leave these damn things for somebody else. Spend good booze for it. We're not taking it. So I packed everything up. I put it in DC-3s and headed 300 miles away. You think I didn't catch it? Again, Worksmith came to my rescue.
So you packed up all those wood floors and took them along with you.
That's right, boy. It's muddy there.
Some pretty good stories we're getting from 90-year-old Ray Malikian of Visalia. And Ray, what was the fighter group and the squadron that you were in?
It was 49th Fighter Group, and I was in the 7th Fighter Squadron.
Uh-huh.
It so happens that the P-40 was probably the worst fighter plane built. It was a good airplane, but, I mean, it was an altitude airplane.
Mm-hmm.
7th Fighter Group Squadron now had been decommissioned, and it was restated here some time ago, and now they're being issued the fastest and the best fighter in the world. Raptor?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so they have that. They had the worst and the best.
Yeah, quite the difference from the P-40 Warhawk. That's more than right. 65 years ago. Now, speaking of a long time passing, recently you were contacted and told, and again, you didn't crash, you weren't shot down in the P-40 that you flew so many times. It had your name on the side of it.
I was really shot down one time, but that was ground fire, but I made it back to an old mud field there and managed to land there. One little guy with a little single-barrel machine gun, popped a hole into my oil radiator, lost all my oil on my engine, quit on me. But I managed to get back.
You just described that pretty matter-of-factly. I imagine at the time that was a little nerve-wracking. Were you sure that you were going to make it back, or were there some moments where you thought you might have to bail?
The engine ran long enough for me to land. I got out and tried to pull the prop on it, and the engine was absolutely frozen. And I was in transports out there, and I took my parachute, climbed in one of them, and pulled them and dropped one off the field, and that was it.
Just all in a day's work, huh?
All in a day's work. And another thing, on one of those missions on that where I got shot down, the Japanese had come down out of the jungles that were out and the planes that were available. The Australian Army was there, and they were going to make a run into the hills on kind of a knife ridge, and we were there beating up the ground and strafing everything around it and softening it up for them. I'm coming down to my final pass, and I'm ready to pull the trigger, start firing, and I see this little old Piper Cub always swerve in front of me, and I, in my gut, I start screaming, I get the blankety blank out of the way. Later on, I found out it was the commanding general of the Australian Army. Letter said it's a letter, you know, and apologized for it. How would that be if I shot him down?
Yeah, you might have. I don't know if you would have been able to pull the strings to get out of that one.
Strings there. But it happens.
Well, and the most recent twist to your story, and I'm amazed every time I talk to a World War II veteran here on Hometown Heroes, where we seek to honor their service and sacrifice for our country, preserve their stories for posterity, and hopefully inspire younger generations to live up to that legacy. It's enough for me to just hear the stories during the war, but your story is pretty impressive recently and pretty amazing, kind of mind-numbing when you think about it. I'm sure you hadn't given too many thoughts to what happened of your old P-40, but tell us how you found out that someone had resurrected this from an airplane graveyard and was trying to put your plane back together.
I got a call from Chris Provost, who did that. He somehow found out that there was a wreck there in an airport dump yard, and he wanted the what was left passed through an Australian builder and ended up in New Zealand. The guy there had it, and I think he'd, from what I understand, ran out of money, and he put it up for bids. So Chris bid on it, bid $151,000, and he got the airplane by $1,000.
Wow. And that's a lot more than the $35,000 you were worried about, huh?
Thinking about it. Anyway, he got it back to Sonoma, where he has an airport there, a private airport. And he started getting parts, cleaning up, finding parts. He could buy some. He had to make some. They had the blueprints on it, and what they couldn't make, couldn't find. They would send the blueprints to Elko Aluminum, and they would make the parts for him. And it took him 8 years to do it. He told me he'd get started on that in the hangar some morning at 7 o'clock, and next time he looked at his watch, it'd be 8, 9 o'clock at night. He got so wrapped up in the darn thing to get it built.
So he told you years ago, one of these days, this plane's going to be airworthy, and I'm going to give you a free ride in your old plane.
I didn't hear from him until about 3 years ago.
Uh-huh.
When he'd looked at the serial numbers, and he, of course, traced it to serial that the plane was issued to me in 1943, I think it was, sometime.
Now, think about the odds of this. First of all, finding it and realizing that that there was still enough of it to find a serial number, to figure out who it belonged to.
Yeah,
secondly, to realize that that pilot was still alive, because a lot of the pilots in a situation like that would no longer be with us. So he finds you, and I guess that gave you something to look forward to for a few years, huh?
Yeah, he found me through another friend that was flying with me. I don't know how he got... Actually, he said my name cropped up from someplace in Australia, some way or another, and worked its way down, and he knew John Miller, who had soon passed away, and called him, and John said, sure, I know, Ray. We talked to each other. So that's how he got hold of me, which was about 3 years ago.
Now, did you ever, in the 3 years that have passed since, did you ever think, well, I don't know if this is actually ever going to happen. I don't know if I'm going to get a chance to get back in that cockpit again.
No, I'm pretty sure every once in a while he'd send me some pictures of what he's done, and the fuselage was done, and a little of this and a little of this. So I knew he was working on it all the time, and he would get it done. And then when I saw it, it absolutely beautiful, beautiful shape. There wasn't any scratches or anything like that. He opened that hangar door, and I looked at it again and said, my God, that's the biggest airplane I've ever seen. I'd forgotten that it was so darn large.
And he even spelled your name right on the canopy, huh?
Except it should have been Major.
I think you'll let that one slide. So you walk up to this P-40, looks pristine, it's completely rebuilt, painted the right color, says R. Malikian on the cockpit with the three Japanese flags symbolizing your kills right underneath it. And then you actually got in it. We're talking about early March 2009, more than 66 years or about that long since the last time you flew this plane, and you got to actually climb in the cockpit and handle the controls?
Yes, I did. Well, I got in the cockpit there in the hangar. Chris had to have a little ladder to get me up in the damn thing.
Not so easy to climb up there anymore.
Well, the first steps are a little high. Anyway, I did get in the cockpit, and I checked it out if I can remember where the flight controls were and the engine controls and the starter and all that sort of stuff. So I got reacquainted with my old airplane, and it felt pretty damn good, I'll tell you.
And he had two sets of controls in there. So,
yeah, two sets of controls, because he's going to use it to take up passengers and those that want to get in and fly a fighter again, and he'll take them up and fly them around for 30 minutes or so, whatever they want.
But he had to christen it by getting you back up in the air in it. What did that feel like when you're back up in the sky looking over the great San Joaquin Valley that you've known and loved for your entire life, and realize that you're in the very same fuselage that you spent all those missions in?
Yeah, well, it felt like you just explained it to me. Amazing. But I could fly it. I could still fly it. You know, he put up his hands. I was in there, and he said, it's all yours now. And I did fly it. I flew it around every place and turned it and all that sort of stuff. It all comes back to you. It's like riding a bicycle. You don't forget it.
And it must be a little nicer when nobody's shooting at you.
Yeah, must be nicer when you're not bored to death, too, on long missions and all that. God, the guys, what they do to me, coming back on a long mission, they sneak up on me, and I'm half asleep, and they'd fire off six machine guns that I'd Thought I'd die all of a sudden. Laugh about the whole thing.
I kept you on your toes.
Right, I did.
And it's clear that you're still on your toes and still able to fly a P-40. Pretty impressive at age 90. Ray, we're out of time for the program today, but I want to thank you so much for sharing those stories with us. And I think everyone listening is thrilled that you got that chance to get up in your plane again. Anything else you want to share with our listeners before we sign off?
Chris said, I gave him a lot of stuff to look at and all that. I said, mail it to me. He says, no. He says, when I get read in one of these days, he says, I'll fly the airplane back to Visalia and you can see it again.
All right. Well, you let us know when that is, because I think a lot of our listeners will want to come watch you and be spectators.
I'll spread the word.
All right. Ray, thank you so much for serving our country and for sharing those stories with us. That's Ray Malikian of Visalia, originally a farm boy from Biola, and still kicking and still flying at age 90. Pretty impressive story that we were privileged to hear today. That's going to do it for Hometown Heroes this afternoon. Fresno State baseball against the Lipscomb Bisons is coming up next. That pregame show will get started in just about a minute from now. Remember to check us out online at kmj580.com, where you can find past editions of this program, and hit a link to tell me about the veteran in your life that you think I ought to catch up with. Thanks so much for listening today. That is Hometown Heroes, and this is News Talk 580 KMJ.
Okay, Paul.
Hey, that was great, Ray. Thank you so much.